Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi.
And today we're going to have another attempted quickfire. They never actually end up being that quick, do they? Look at some more questions that you guys, the listeners, have been sending in. Thanks for that. Before we kick off, a reminder, you can email us molad@premier.org.uk. Or if you're still on Twitter/X, you can tweet me there at TSWyatt, TSWYATT. But Brandon sent us an email from the East Coast of the United States, and he says this: I'm a 28-year-old man, Christian man on the East Coast of the US, and I'm currently using dating apps. That's not at all because I like them, but I feel like there aren't any good alternatives. This is an area where I really feel like the church has failed, especially here in the Northeast, where the churches are smaller and it's not necessarily very common to be a Christian. A lot of time is given to talking about marriage and parenthood, but I've yet to find a church that offers any kind of singles groups or events or ministry, and most of the churches have gender segregated small groups too. So we're given a radically different sexual ethic and then left to live that out via methods and spaces and apps that have been created by the culture around us and with little to no guidance. I worry a lot about the effect of these apps when you look at hundreds or thousands of your brothers and sisters in Christ and make snap judgments about whether to swipe right or not. And it all happens in a space where we are explicitly not looking to truly get to know each other, unless things really seem to be working out. We all know we came to these apps because there is one thing we want from each other. I don't think that is a healthy way for us to practice looking at each other. But in a church that sometimes feels like it has little to no interest in making the space and time to get to know each other, and that neglects single people in general, what else is there to do?
Well, I certainly resonate with a lot of that, and in particular this idea that what evangelical churches tend to do is they give a radically different sexual ethic. They promote a radically different sexual ethic, but in terms of the actual working out of that in practice, they often fail in providing a really positive and healthy environment in which single people can work that out, that ethic.
Yeah, I think that's a really perceptive way of describing the problem, that, as you say, churches hold up what is an increasingly countercultural way to live and then say, go on then, and everyone telling you to do this is already happily ensconced in a marriage with children and doesn't have to think about dating anymore and hasn't had to think about it for 10 to 20 years. And so if you are a younger single person, you're often left, I think, wondering, well, do you have any idea what it's like to go and find a brother or sister in Christ who shares that countercultural sexual ethic and is looking for the same things I am? How on earth am I going to go and find this person and build a relationship with them to get to the end goal that you told me is what I'm supposed to be aiming for? It does feel a little bit like a bait and switch, you know, that you're almost set up to fail sometimes.
Yeah, and of course, the fundamental issue is not at all new. It goes back hundreds of years, isn't it? If I genuinely want to follow Christ, I may be in a relatively small church. There aren't that many people of my age group. It seems unlikely that I'm going to, by chance, meet someone who is going to be suitable as a kind of partner. So what am I supposed to do? And it's interesting that in the bad old days when I was growing up, it was basically Christian organizations like camps and volunteering and things you did over the summer and CUs. And it was Christian organizations which basically provided an environment in which you could meet people who cared about the same things that you did.
Hmm.
And where you were most likely to find somebody who shared your vision of life and your concerns and who you would feel, here's someone who could be a life partner for me.
I'm just reminded of a slightly cruel joke that was common currency when I was a teenager. Here in central London, a lot of people would sometimes go, in addition to their kind of normal smallest church, to HDB, Holy Trinity Brompton, on kind of evening services, ostensibly to kind of, you know, soak up a different style of worship. And this is like, you know, one of the, by British standards, a mega church with approaching 1,000 people coming on a Sunday. And but often it was really about meeting other young Christians outside of your own pool, so much so that people used to joke that HDB really stood for Hunt the Bride.
In fact, there were many jokes like that. So I remember the previous organization, which with the initial CSSM, and that stood for Come Single, Soon Married.
Yeah, so as you say, in some sense, this is a common conversation topic among young Christians, and where in times gone by, it was quote-unquote solved by creating lots of ministry opportunities for young people to mingle, you know, whether that might be a summer camp or a gap year project overseas, or a kind of joint, you know, all-town kind of Christian mission where lots of churches collaborate.
So tell us, Tim, how did you find your life partner?
I met Jess at the Christian Union at university.
And I met my wife at the student events in my church.
There you go. So it works. It can work. But I understand. I sympathize that there is, it often feels like, at least looking around my circle of friends, there's kind of a wave of relationships that start, including mine, in your early 20s. While you're involved in church or Christian unions or summer camps or some other kind of parachurch organization. But if you're 28, like our question, a questioner Brandon is, I know I've spoken to friends who feel like if you miss that wave of people hooking up and settling down and getting married by the time they're 24, 25, 26, you might have, often sometimes people feel like they've exhausted their own kind of social circle of church and parachurch friends, everyone who's potentially has already got married, and so you have to start looking further afield. And in that instance, I don't blame people for going to apps, whether they're Christian apps or not, because fundamentally that is how people meet each other. If you're you know, as Brandon says, you know, we're all came to these apps for the same thing, looking for one thing, and that can be unhealthy, but at least it gives a clarity, you know, where you're not just like rocking up in a bar and just trying to spot the kind of WWJD bracelet. But if you're on Salt, you know, the app that we referred to last time, you are fully aware that everyone here is a Christian of some description and everyone here is looking for a husband or a wife.
But that's part of the issue, isn't it? Because I understand that if you just take it outside of the Christian world and just look at secular culture as a whole, I understand that dating apps are absolutely dominant in terms of finding someone to hook up with. And the reason is that there's such anxiety, particularly on campus, that you will be misinterpreted, even inviting a girl or a bloke to have a drink or to do something else together could be interpreted as abusive, manipulative, patriarchal, you know, you name it. So the one thing you know on the dating app is, as you say, everyone is there for one reason only. And so you don't have to worry that by swiping right, you could be accused of
a microaggression.
Exactly. No, I think quite genuinely. So it's a bizarre thing that the normal interactions, whereas, you know, again, in the bad old days, you know, inviting someone, would you like to come for a meal, come for a drink, you know, do you want to go and see a film? You know, this was just completely routine, normal, and she can always say no, push off, I'm not interested. But it seems to have become much more complex and challenging just to do that ordinary social thing of expressing interest in someone else.
And it's out of that context that you saw things like the kind of courtship movement, which was never particularly big in among evangelicals on this side of the Atlantic, but, you know, dating from kind of Josh Harris's seminal book, I Kiss Dating Goodbye, this whole idea of a kind of, there's a radically different way to do dating. This predates the apps, but it's the idea that Christians don't date in the way that normal people do, by, you know, becoming friends with a girl, asking her out on a date, going for dinner, going to the cinema, getting to know each other. But actually it should all be done kind of hyper-intentionally and through the kind of under the protective aegises of your, if you're a woman, of your dad. And so it's this kind of pre-industrialization world where you court with your father as there as a chaperone, kind of in the family home, and it's all a bit weird and creepy. But that was right. That was quite influential and quite popular as a way of kind of solving that riddle, which I guess is kind of inching back towards kind of arranged marriages, which would have been the norm for Christians for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say that actually, isn't this part of the fruit of this bizarre thing called non-arranged marriages? You know, that in all previous cultures, marriage was arranged. It wasn't usually the dad. It was usually the mum. I mean, mothers were much more likely to be the matchmakers, but often in many cultures there were official matchmakers, weren't there? There were people who were responsible to. It was their job to know who was around, who was available, and who might get along with one another. And I remember a very interesting conversation with a colleague of mine at work. And we got on talking in one of those intermissions between in working where you're just chatting together. And he said his marriage was arranged. His parents had arranged for him to meet his future wife. And he talked about it very positively. You know, he said that trusting their judgment, he felt they were much more likely to end up, you know, they genuinely wanted to do the best for their son, and they were much more likely to find someone who matched interests and whose personality and thought they would get on well, and that actually it set the place in which love could grow. So it's not that there wasn't love there, but it wasn't that we fell in love, got this amazing chemistry, and then wanted to live together. It was that we were chosen to live together, and then love would grow out of that. So isn't part of the problem this sort of over-idealized, romanticized view that you're looking for the right person, the person who all the chemistry is going to, person is going to transform my life, and, you know, all the bells are going to ring and I'm just going to know they're the right one, and then we fall in love together. That isn't a biblical model at all, is it?
No, it's not. And I think there's certainly something I would agree with there about kind of almost a fetishization of marriage, or the idolatry of marriage, which you see, I think, which is largely a kind of Hollywood thing, but has kind of bled unquestioned into church culture. And I think there's certainly something where we should maybe slightly push back and say, like, yeah, it's really important that you and your wife or husband are attracted to each other and they have lots in common and are good friends, but actually, you know, there's no evidence that there is the one, and you don't need to wait for literal lightning to strike. And actually, if you find someone for whom you share important values, you're attracted to them, they're attracted to you, like, you, that can be, that, as you say, the foundation to build a really lifelong happy marriage, even if it's not like from day one you can't take your hands off each other or whatever. So I definitely think we can maybe kind of turn the temperature down on some of the kind of romanticization of marriage. But I think equally there is a misleading kind of dewy-eyed look back at the past at how wonderful the era of arranged marriages were, which I think there have been lots of arranged marriages that have been very successful, but there have also been tons that were being, that were awful, because it fundamentally says you and the most important human relationship you're going to have over the next 70 years is something that can be controlled by your parents, fundamentally, or your community. And that is just rife for abuse and for power plays and transactionalism. And actually, while it's true that the kind of idea of marrying for love is a relatively recent historical concept, I would argue, put aside the love, marrying out of free will is a fundamental Christian concept. I don't believe you see in the Bible God's endorsement for the idea that people should be forced to marry against their will.
Yeah.
And that's both whether to marry at all or stay single, but also who, I believe that also pertains to who you marry.
Yeah.
And actually, I think there's something important about the generous, freely given love that God gives us, that we're supposed to be modeling in our marriages, the love that God has for us, the love that Christ has for the church. And that is not coerced, enforced, expected upon, even by kind of loving parents. It's freely chosen. And so I think I would push back and say, actually, there is something beautiful and deeply Christian about the idea of saying, I choose who to offer my sacrificial, submitting covenant love to, not someone I'm told to.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a bit of a caricature, because Christian marriage, right from its very inception, has always been seen as freely given consent. I mean, that's the difference between rape, put it crudely, and consensual relationships, isn't it? That marriage is never coerced. There is always the freely given consent. And, you know, that's why it's so significant, I think, when, you know, the angel appears to Mary and gives her this amazing news and says, well, whether you like it or not, Mary, that's what's going to happen. It isn't like that. Mary says, you know, I am the bondslave of the Lord. Let it be to me, as you have said. In other words, I give my consent. I agree.
Yeah.
And that's a critical thing in every Christian marriage service is, do you agree? Do you take this person, this man, this woman? And you have to say, I agree. I give my consent.
But we have to, you're absolutely right. That has always been baked into the theology of it. But we need to be realistic and clear-eyed that in many, many times in many Christian cultures, women in particular, daughters, have been told who they're going to marry. Yeah. And they might have said in the front of church, I agree. But in reality, they had no real free will because of the overweening patriarchal power of the father or the community or the priest in that context. Well, and actually, for better or for worse, as we've dismantled kind of arranged marriages, we have also dismantled the likelihood of particularly women being, you know, giving technical consent, but in reality being knowing very well that she doesn't really have a choice. And if she says no, there's going to be serious negative consequences for her.
Yeah, unfortunately, abusive, coercive men are just as present in the current era as they ever were. So I'm sure, sadly, there are still women, yes, being coerced into marriage and into sex. But, I think we agree that there is something very positive about this genuine desire to choose. I think it's the transactional element. You know, it's the kind of cattle market element of the dating app, you know, where each person, you know, all these thousands of people are presenting their best side. They're saying, you know, how can I present myself, which would be attractive to a mate, you know, that I've got a good sense of humour, that I'm adaptable and approachable.
I care about my appearance, but not too much. Yeah.
I love music, you know. I mean,
G-S-O-H. Yeah.
G-S-O-H. You know, for a long time, when I read those Lonely Hearts adverts, I kept seeing these initials GSOH. I didn't have a clue what it stood for, and I came to the conclusion it probably stood for good skin, own hair.
Very important things to identify in a mate, of course. Yeah, I think I would agree that, and Brandon puts his finger on in the question that actually asking you to say, saying here are 100 pictures and, you know, 30 word maximum text profiles of 100 of my sisters in Christ, and I am encouraged or expected to be able to, with a flick of my finger, decide who is a possible mate and who is not. I think that is deeply unhealthy, and maybe I'd go as far as to say unchristian way of trying to find a wife. My pushback would be, my take is, I don't think dating apps are intrinsically bad. I just think that we need to use them with great care to be aware of how they might be forming and shaping our perceptions and our judgments and our culture and attitude to this process. But if you're simply saying, this is a new form of technology that helps me to meet other female Christians who are single and to therefore hopefully meet them in the flesh after we've got to know each other on the app and do it the old-fashioned way of seeing, is there chemistry? Do we like each other? Do we share important values? Can we see ourselves as a couple? I don't think that's in itself bad. I just think we need to be really, really careful about not letting ourselves fall into that kind of cattle market approach and that incredibly superficial, judgmental, skin deep approach of who is a possibility and who is not.
Yeah, I would just want to take a slightly different take or add to that, which I basically agree. And that is that the problem is that the church has bought into this complete sexual romantic obsession as the same of the secular age. And that a very important part of this is to try to help young single people see the importance of building non-sexual friendships, deep, intimate, self-giving, Christ-centered friendships. And that maybe it's more important to be building those kind of friendships as a young single person than it is to be spending all the time in the cattle market trying to find a romantic partner, because we've devalued the importance of non-sexual friendship. So, I mean, it just so happens that I've written a book about this, but it is something that I think it is really important, that the extent to which unintentionally the modern church seems to have bought into the sexual obsession of our secular age.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I was going to say, you know, Brandon says that the church has little or no interest in making space for single people to get to know each other. And I'm thinking, you know, yeah, that's true. And maybe churches should do more kind of single nights. And, you know, I'm aware of at least one of the big Christian summer festivals here in the UK that for many years has had a speed dating night built into the schedule. And I know a married couple who first met on the speed dating night at New Wine. And you know, on one level, it feels a bit absurd that, you know, you've come away with your church family for a week camping to do some worship and Bible teaching and in between do a bit of dating. But maybe I was thinking, you know, actually, maybe that's no bad thing. That helps young single Christians get to know each other and to not be kind of tempted, as it were, to settle for second best and find someone who doesn't share your values and your love of Jesus. But then the flip side is, if churches are constantly running singles nights, they are buying into that thing you just said, which is that you're incomplete until you're married, and so we have to put loads of time, effort and money into making sure that all the single congregants in our parish are married off, rather than saying you're fine as you are. Singleness is an honorable vocation. You may even be called to it for lifelong. Are you impressing into that? Why not focus on life-giving friendships and that kind of stuff? So I feel a bit conflicted on that one.
Yeah, and just because you're single doesn't mean you're therefore locked out of intimacy. You're locked out of deep soul-sharing relationships. That's the myth, you know, the lie that the secular world says. Unless you've got someone who gives you all this sexual chemistry, your life is just a pale reflection of what might be. Whereas the idea that deep, you know, that people, what so many people are looking for is intimacy. They're looking for connection. And instead of helping people to build those deep, deep friendships with people of both the same and the opposite sex, that's the priority rather than trying to get everyone paired off.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities, you'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
To wrap up this episode, we wanted to have a brief chat about a really interesting, concerning news story that you spotted, Dad, coming over from the US in their torturously slow-moving election process, which is underway. There was a primary happening in New Hampshire, the first primary, I think, presidential primary. But there, a bunch of people started getting robo phone calls that appeared to sound like they were coming from Joe Biden's own voice, telling them that they should skip voting in the primary. Did you see that story?
Yeah. So this is something which has been predicted, actually, for quite a long time. You know, the basic technology for doing deepfakes, including audio deepfakes, has been around for some time. But people have predicted that, you know, what is this going to do in elections? And lo and behold, it's actually happened. So using one of these generative AI models, you actually only need a relatively short amount of audio, of genuine audio from the person you're trying to imitate and simulate. And then you feed that into the model. And then you can type whatever you like, and it comes out in the voice that you want it to. Mm-hmm. And so voters in New Hampshire were rather surprised to receive a telephone call to hear Joe Biden on the end. And they were even more surprised when he was telling them to not to vote for the primaries, but to save their ballot for the general election in November. And I think thousands of people got this call, and it seemed very personalized. It was, you know, they'd been selected because they were particularly likely to vote.
Mm. And it's an investigation has quite quickly kind of traced it to a couple of Texas companies, apparently, which were involved in setting up the robo calls. But I guess it, and I think the US federal authorities have now made it illegal to do robo calls that use AI generated voices. Do you think this is going to start happening more and more as the technology, the kind of bar to entry to doing this kind of sophisticated AI impersonation is lower and lower? You know, but we'll have videos of Rishi Sunak appearing to say things that he's never said for our election later this year and that kind of thing.
I do. I think, you know, sadly, it seems impossible to put the genie back in the bottle. You know, these programs are widely available, freely downloadable, and it doesn't take a lot of technical skill to create deepfake video or audio. And it's really concerning to see where this is going. I think it just leads to a general attitude of mistrust. How much impact this is going to have on elections, nobody really knows. But in other areas, so the most extraordinary thing I read just a few days ago was somebody who worked for a big company receives a rather strange email asking him to join a Zoom call to discuss a financial transaction for the company. And he thinks it's a bit strange, but he comes on the Zoom call, and there apparently on the Zoom call are senior members of the company, executives who he recognises and who are all agreeing that he should do this transaction. So he agrees and transfers a whole lot of the company's money into another account. And it then turns out that every single person on that Zoom call were deep fakes. They were not the genuine people. So you can see the power, can't you? If it's possible, you know, to create such accurate, carefully crafted deep fakes, who can you trust, even when this seems to be somebody I know and is and I recognize them.
Hmm. You know, if I had to guess, what this leads to is a kind of entire total collapse of kind of useful information sharing online. You know, because if, as is already happening on some social media networks, if 80, even 50% of what you're seeing is known to be spurious and disinformation, then people will just understandably conclude nothing is true on the internet, which is, you know, helpful in one sense in that they're less likely to be misled. But I just think it has catastrophic effects for the discourse and for the quality of our democracy and our debate, let alone for people working in the media, such as myself, if a whole generation grows up basically believing that everything you read on the internet is fake and untrue, because they can no longer distinguish between AI generated misinformation and legitimate media. You actually end up in this kind of backwards, you lose the benefits of the last kind of 500 years since the printing press, of all that advantages in communication and all the benefits it's brought to us. And we just end up, you know, talking directly with our friends and our families, and we don't have this kind of participatory, complex, million-strong democracy that relies on clear communication and trustworthy communication.
Yeah, and you can certainly, I mean, that's the worst-case scenario, isn't it? A sort of dystopic view. I don't think it has to be like that. In the end, you know, what it shows is that the very close relationship between our understanding of truth and who you trust, you know, and to put it in simplistic terms, what is true is what a person who I trust tells me. In the end, truth it's not an objective, scientific, neutral thing. It is actually truth ultimately at its heart comes from people who are trusted. So positively, I think it would be possible to rebuild from the ground upwards some kind of trusted technology. There are technological possible ways of doing this. I mean, we still trust, by and large, a bank to put use our credit cards and put our money there. They have very sophisticated counterfeit detection methods, and they're not foolproof, but most of the time they work. So that there are kind of technical ways of it just means, yeah, I think we have to be much more cautious, and we have to look to build up again a network of trust. And who do I trust? I mean, you know, we talked before about Substack, didn't we? And that's one of the interesting things in Substack. You know, I find an individual who I trust. And provided they're continuing, of course, they could be hacked and they could be saying something completely false. But by and large, you know, the motivation to hack a small Substack is less, isn't it? And I'm finding someone who I trust and they're speaking with some kind of authentic voice. I don't trust them 100%. But I trust them 95% that this is probably straight, and I'm interested and want to listen and learn from them.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's the first kind of inklings of a shift in the kind of social graph of the net, and we're coming out of the era of kind of like full octane fire hose social media, where absolutely everything was mediated online in this huge pool, and maybe things are starting to fracture down. You know, you're seeing new social networks emerge and some of the older ones kind of lose some of their cultural dominance. And maybe that's a healthier thing, to have a more fragmented landscape where we have smaller pools and more peer-to-peer stuff, rather than it all being mediated through the Facebook feed or the Instagram algorithm or whatever it is. And we can start to rebuild trust. I was just reminded, when you're talking about technological solutions, you know, the conversation 20 years ago was, you know, is spam going to destroy email? And then, you know, the companies applied their brains and their computing power to it and basically largely fixed the problem of spam. In that, you know, every day I do receive a spam or email or two, but Gmail is 99.9% accurate at filtering out of my inbox. And so I don't notice, and I can still trust the bulk of the emails that arrive in my inbox, while always having to apply a degree of kind of scrutiny to the ones that ask me to send money somewhere or appear to come from a bank. But so... yeah, hopefully we can come up with something similar for deep fakes and for AI and all this stuff that is never going to be 100%, but at least keeps us ahead in the kind of endless arms race.
Yeah, another example is it was widely said that sort of counterfeit music you know, illegal copying was going to destroy the entire music industry and there wasn't going to be any solution to it. But lo and behold, again, technical solutions were found. And most people are perfectly happy to use legitimate sites like Spotify and so on. So I think there's probably not a reason for doom and gloom, but I do think that democracy and elections are under particular attack because I suppose if you think about it, when it comes to an election, this kind of small group peer-to-peer stuff is much less helpful, isn't it? I mean, in the end, we do need to know what's happening at a national level.
And this is a little superior, so forgive me, but part of it is really because Americans have allowed their elections to become such enormous kind of money-guzzling, multi-year monstrosities where there are super PACs with hundreds of millions of dollars to spend on behalf of candidates. You know, there is obviously people as a do attempt to manipulate UK elections, but it's on such a smaller scale because we have regulated and kept them smaller and less kind of bloated by money and special interests. And frankly, it's also a consequence of an incredibly divided and divisive society. You know, and I think a large part of the solution, again, for America is finding ways to heal the polarization between Democrats and Republicans. And then there is just frankly less of a market for it and less interest in bad actors trying to sow dissension when people are broadly more committed to the kind of democratic idea that we're playing on a level playing field. We have different ideas, but we're all fundamentally Americans trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in that.
Right, shall we call it quits? Thanks very much, everyone, for listening. And thank you to everyone who keeps sending in questions. We'll try to get to some more of those in an episode in a few weeks' time. You can email molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And as always, there's lots more resources of things to stimulate your thinking at johnwyatt.com. But we'll see you next week for another episode. Bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.